Now stay tuned for To Your Health on WPVC LP Charlottesville, the show where food is on the table and center stage. To Your Health is brought to you by Hamilton's at First and Main, celebrating 20 years of sustainable fine dining on the downtown mall. Now here are your hosts, Larry Stopper and MC Blair.
Hey, good morning, good morning, good morning. MC Blair here. Larry Stopper, my co-host. How are you, Larry?
Good morning. I'm doing just fine. Nice to be back here on WPVC.
The progressive voice of Charlottesville.
All right. We are bringing you To Your Health this morning. Mike, why don't you introduce our guest?
Well, we have John Whiteside this morning from Wolf Creek Farm. Go ahead.
Beef is heart smart when it's grass-fed. From a certified grass farm like Wolf Creek in Madison County, Virginia. Unlike most grocery store beef, Wolf Creek's unique products are loaded with omega-3s and four times the vitamin A, an antioxidant associated with lower risk of heart disease. The farmer, John Whiteside, takes pride in practicing sustainable farm stewardship by making sure the soil has all the right minerals, the animals always have fresh pasture and everything else they need for good health. Healthy soil plus healthy cows equal healthy meals on your plate. And believe it or not, fewer doctor visits. So now you can understand why beef is heart smart. As long as it's grass-fed from farms like Wolf Creek.
And that's so true, John. Why don't you tell us a little bit, about your background.
Early, what brought you to farming out in Madison County?
Well, it was actually by accident. I didn't start in my career as a farmer. I was in business, international business in telecommunications and computing, and I had a farm in Upperville, a horse farm, where I fox hunted when I found the time to be outdoors. And I tired of keeping the pastures clipped because horses aren't very good grazers. Yeah. So I bought a couple of steers to put them out, and it worked perfectly. At the end of the summer, I said, well, gee, this works so well. Maybe I can eat the lawnmower and really make this work. Yeah. So I tried the beef and didn't like it very well. So one thing led to another. I started experimenting with different feeds and figured out it wasn't the feed. It was the genetics. And then getting to grass. Mm-hmm. That led me to the point where I needed more land, and Madison beckoned.
Wow, wow.
So what breeds do you raise out there?
We have two breeds, Red Devons and Aberdeen Angus, both of which are British breeds, selected because they do very well on grass, and they marble and make tender, good-eating beef.
Okay. I can attest to that. That's really good stuff. You had mentioned something about when you first got the farm here in Madison, how you had to do a lot of work on getting the soil, having the right soil profile. What'd you do?
Yeah, so the key is everything starts from the soil. If you right. think about your own health, you're made up 95% of four key elements, nitrogen, oxygen, carbon, and hydrogen. And the other 5% is made up of trace minerals, all of which come to you from the soil. So, and they regulate everything. They regulate all the enzymes, all of your reproductive system, your health system, your immune system, everything. And so the soil is what's critical in raising any form of agriculture, whether it's plant or animal. So the first thing I did was looking for a piece of property. I had to find soil that hadn't been destroyed and bombarded with chemicals, which is very hard now to find yes. soil. If it's good flat land, it's probably being cropped mm-hmm. and had a lot of pesticides and herbicides on it. If it's hill land, it's probably had an orchard on it and had a lot of DDT and ALAR and other things. So finding land that hadn't been heavily cropped was hard. And the only reason it hadn't been cropped was because it wasn't very good land. So you end up with the hill land that doesn't grow very well. So it is deficient in a lot of the key minerals that you need.
Okay.
So then you start with land that hasn't been ruined yet, and you look to build it back up again. So we started with land that had zero organic content in it, and went about sustainable farming to build that soil back up.
And just the virtue of sustainable practice in your farming builds it back up.
Yeah, if you think about farming, traditional farming, we always had animals and crops together.
Right.
And the reason for that is the nutrient cycle.
Sure.
The manure from the animal goes back into the soil, which feeds the microbes in the soil, which then grows the soil, grows the organic content in the soil. A lot of true grass farmers will argue when you ask them how many employees do they have working for them, they say millions, if you count the earthworms, the dung beetles, the microbes. And the good news is we don't have to pay them anything, just give them some manure to eat.
Do you have sort of a ratio that you have in terms of cows per acre? Is that something?
Yeah, it depends on the land itself.
Sure.
But here in Virginia, without really improving your land, you could use about 5 to 1, so 5 acres per animal unit year.
Okay.
So that would be a cow for a year. It takes 2 years to grow a calf from birth to finish, so it's going to take 10-acre years. Now, we've got our soils much more productive, so we're down to 3 to 1. So
okay.
We can run one animal on every 3 acres.
Wow. Well, we're listening to Your Health, and we're talking to John Whiteside from Wolf Creek Farm in Madison, Virginia. John, you make your own hay, don't you?
Yeah, so part of being able to guarantee to your customer that not only is there no bad chemical in the beef that they're eating, but there's a lot of good nutrient-dense enzymes and minerals in the beef, is you have to control the whole system. So we don't buy any cattle in. It's our genetics. The calves were conceived and born on the farm. They live on the farm their entire life. And then in terms of what they're eating, they're only eating grazing on the pastures 365 days a year and eating grass that was made into hay off those same pastures.
So you rotate the cattle so they don't overgraze a particular pasture, correct?
Yes. So one of the keys to sustainable farming versus conventional or industrial farming in cattle is you never confine your animals, so you don't bring them into a barn and feed them, and you don't set stock them or just put them out on the range as they do in some areas in the West. You put them in a pasture at precisely the right time, where the grass is at the most nutrient-dense height. You graze that grass down, but leave enough of the growth in the grass itself so that when the cattle leave that field, the grass will rebound and actually will grow even faster because it had the top nipped off.
Oh my.
So you're feeding the cattle the very best, and you're helping the grass to grow even more. So you're getting a 2-for-1. Your cattle are growing quickly, and your grass is growing quickly.
Are you adding anything to the soil at all, or are you simply doing it with the cattle themselves?
No, I
couldn't think of the right word that I'm allowed to say on the radio, so you know what I mean.
We call it fertility.
There you go.
The answer is the soil got denuded over glacial time.
Mm-hmm.
So because we're in a 42-inch-a-year rainfall area, we have a lot of leaching of the soil, and that's why the Virginia soils are so red. And the rocks get broken down and the minerals leave and go downstream and into the Chesapeake. So if you want to build that up over geologic time, you can do it without putting a lot of additives back on your soil. If you, like I, start this late in life and want to get it going quickly, you have to amend your soils. And so what we did was put down a lot of seaweed, kelp, a lot of animal manures,
okay,
extra manures, and then mineral mixes, which we test the soil every year, and then get trace minerals, which could be rock phosphates, it could be Tennessee green sand, it could be zinc, magnesium, molybdenum, any of the trace metals that you need that are deficient in your soil, you can put those back on as amendments. You can also put them back through the animal by mixing those into the mineral that you're feeding the animal as its salt.
Okay.
And then the animal will absorb what it needs from that mineral, and any residual that they didn't process will come out in their manure and their urine and be spread over your land naturally.
Oh, my. Mm-hmm. That is great. You also are a certified grass farm, and I understand that that certification is difficult, and you can't buy it.
Right. One of the key things for consumers is understanding what they're buying, mm-hmm. what they're getting. And certifications are one way for people to shortcut that and not have to be grass farmers themselves to understand what it is we're doing. The challenge with any of those certifications is the more pronounced or the more common they become, the more they're taken over by large industrial agriculture. And we can see organic has gone the way where it used to mean that you were naturally farming your land with no external amendments or non-natural amendments. It's now defined by big ag as being, you know, not having heinous chemicals. In grass farming, the key certification that we have is from the American Grass-Fed Association and from Animal Welfare Approved, both of which say it's a family-owned farm, it's being managed sustainably, there's no antibiotics, no hormones, no pesticides, no herbicides. The animals live their entire lives on the farm, and they're raised without any grain or other additives or inputs in their feed.
Wow.
And let me just catch you up here real quick. You are listening to Your Health here on WPVC. I'm Larry Stopper here with my co-host, MC Blair, and we are interviewing John Whiteside of Wolf Creek Farm out in Madison, Virginia. So, Mike, you got another question for John.
I do. I wanted to, if you could speak a little bit. I've seen labels when I go into a grocery store, natural beef. And I know that for me, it's what comes from nature, you know, without messing it up or adding anything or any of that. It's just the way it is. Unfortunately, I believe that that term gets bandied around quite a bit by people, you know, Madison Avenue for one. But if you could speak a little bit about...
Sure. Yeah, so the key, the only way you really know what's in your food is if you know your farmer. And you visit the farm and you see how he farms. And you trust your farmer because you know your farmer. So anything that you're looking for from a label is a surrogate for that, a replacement for that. So you need to know what the label says and who's issuing it. So it's very important to understand what these various terms, grass-fed, natural, organic, mean to different people. One of the best sources of understanding labels, I think, is on Animal Welfare Approved. They've got a whole tutorial on all the labels that are out there and what they really mean. Mm. Natural, to most people, means as in nature.
Right.
But to the Madison Avenue marketing people, what that means is we want people to feel good about what they're eating, so we're going to say it came from nature. Well, all chemicals come from nature.
Yeah, they're on the periodic table, yeah, I guess.
So. That's correct. So something is natural if it means it's not alien. So
if it hasn't landed here from Mars, it's natural.
I guess. So the keys to really look for, if you don't have the time to invest in actually visiting a farm and talking with a farmer, is to go to some of these sites like Animal Welfare Approved and educate yourself on the label. Grass-fed, for example, in the USDA definition means something very different than it does to a farmer like me.
Mm-hmm. What does it mean?
For me, what it means is that the animal was on pasture 365 days a year, never went into confinement, that it was eating only what it picked off the ground, what it grazed.
What it chose to eat.
Right. And and or hays that were made from the same grasses when they got mature and were cut and stored with no additives put on them. What grass-fed means to other people is animals that were born through artificial insemination, that were taken away from their mother early, that were put into feedlots, and that were fed processed vegetable products, whether those are alfalfa cubes or some other item, in a feedlot, and that's grass-fed.
Mm. Wow.
Let me ask a question here that might be slightly off track here, because when I was a young man, I did some dairy cow raising, very small, lived on a plot of land where we had a milk cow. And if when we had a male calf, we would raise it. But we never could seem to figure out how to wean that cow. Is that a natural process? We could never get that steer to stop drinking all the milk.
Well, the best way to wean a calf is to have another calf come along and kick him off the tit. Nature will always wean a calf because the new one will come along.
Okay, and mom cattle, just pushes them away eventually?
Right.
Okay.
And cattle are very similar to humans in terms of literally about a 28-day estrus cycle and a 9-month gestation. It's a little shorter, but about that. So you look to have a calf off of a cow every year.
Okay.
And most commercial farmers want to wean the calf early and sell it into the sale barn to somebody who's going to take it into the stocker operator or whatever. We, because we're going to keep that animal for its whole life until we harvest it, leave it on the mother until it's about 8 or 9 months old. And then by that point, the mother is pregnant again, and she's starting to dry up. Her udder is drying up as she's getting ready to have her next calf. And the calf has learned how to eat grass. She's taught him how to graze, and he's really just coming back for comfort, not because he's getting much nutrition from the mother. At that point, what we do is we call fence line weaning. We separate the mother from the calf by an electric fence. We put one on one side, one on the other, and the mamas can still see their calves and smell their calves and vice versa. And so they're not worried. They're not stressed. And then what we do is we open up the gates on the back end of both of their pastures, and the more mature calves or the more indifferent mamas will go through the gates out of their pastures to get better grass to graze. And one by one, the cow-calf pairs will make their ways out, basically sending their kids off to college. And by the time a few days are passed, all of the calves have been weaned and there's been no stress and no a little bit of bawling.
That's great. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, that's pretty interesting.
That is.
And when we would deliver every now and then, not all that often, but certainly we knew local farmers that sometimes it was quite a wrestling match to get the calf out of mom. Is that a problem that you encounter?
Well, you get that in any form of a mammal where you have a difficult birth, and that's genetics.
Okay.
And so the farmer's job is to make sure he's got a calf-easing bull over a first-time heifer. The first time she calves, all the ligaments aren't stretched. You know, it's a tough job. So you want to make sure she has a small calf the first time around, so you make sure you put the right bull over her. So if you pay attention to your genetics, you're not going to get those problems. The way we get those problems is by trying to push the breeds to do things that they're not meant to do, and that's where we get all the cesarean sections, and that's where, of course, you need all the vets and all the other issues. We haven't pulled a calf in over 6 years.
No way. Really?
Yeah.
Wow. That's
just paying attention to the mom. And, you know, when you're picking your replacement heifers from your heifer calves, one of the things you're looking for is a calving ease mama. If she's got the right hips and the right disposition to be a good mama, and if she doesn't, then you're not going to keep her. Or if she has problems with her first calf, you're going to get rid of her. And that way you don't keep that bloodline in your genetics.
Okay.
Well,
let's do one more question for John, and then we'll go to break.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask you, where can people get your beef? I was at J&M Provisions talking to Matt and Alex. Hey, guys, hope you're listening. And they give you their best. They wanted me to to relay that to you. But where else could people get your beef?
Yeah, so this is a big challenge. We've destroyed the old traditional farm-to-plate infrastructure. So gone are the small local slaughterhouses or abattoirs. Gone are the local butchers who are artisans that know how to cut down a carcass and deliver an individual cut to the table at home. And gone are the specialty grocers. Now, we're bringing that back again, bit by bit, and you picked a good example. JM Stock Provisions here in Charlottesville are bringing back the art of butchering and connecting with the farmers that are growing local animals, raising local animals, and then butchering that and offering it to the end consumer. So that's a good good alternative. We do sell through specialty grocers, so out in Crozet, Greenwood Grocers carries our product. And here in town at Rebecca's, you can get our product. You can get it up in Madison at the Mennonite Yoder's Country Market. And you can also buy from the farm at our website. Give us an email and put an order in, and we do come down every 2 weeks here to Charlottesville and make a delivery of other Saturday.
That's great. We're going to go to a break now, and we're listening. You're listening to Your Health with MC Blair and Larry Stopper, and our guest today, we're going to carry him over a little bit into the next segment, John Whiteside from Wolf Creek Farm. Back after this.
We're back now on To Your Health with MC Blair and Larry Stopper, and we are interviewing John Whiteside from Wolf Creek Farm. And John, as we were ending there, we were looking over at our producer, and he's like, what's that website? Have you given us the website address? Why don't you give us that website address?
That's pretty simple. All one word, wolf with no E, wolfcreekfarm.com.
All right. So, Mike, you got another question for John there? You want me to jump in here?
Yeah, you look like you got something there.
Well, we've been we were talking about animal husbandry and raising cattle, and one of the things that I was curious about, because out in my neck of the woods in Nelson County, I keep seeing belted Galloways, and they struck me as kind of an unusual looking cow, and I was just wondering, are they a fad? What do you raise? And fill us in a little bit about that.
Well, everyone loves Oreo cookies.
Yeah, Oreo cows.
So they're basically three different kinds of cattle. They're British breeds. There are continental breeds, and there are the tropical or indicus breeds. The British breeds are smaller, and they marble very well, make tender beef on grass. The continental breeds are larger, a little bit leaner, and do better with mixed feeds. And then the tropical breeds are hardy and tough and can live in climates that obviously are tropical. Longhorns are a good example of that, Texas Longhorns. We chose the British breeds because we want to produce grass-fed, natural, highly marbled, tasty, tender beef. And the British breeds are the best breeds for that. Then within the British breeds, if you go to the British Isles, there are cows that produce milk and cows that produce beef. And then there are what are called dual-purpose breeds that do both. They don't do either one exceptionally, but they do both pretty well. And we selected the Red Devon, because that is the beef side of the Devon herd. There's the milking Devon and the Red Devon for the beef. We chose the Red Devon. We also chose the Aberdeen Angus, which is smaller than what most people think of as a Black Angus, because it does so well on grass and produces beef. The Belted Galway is smaller still and comes from Galway.
Of course.
And so you can imagine the climate that was growing and that its genetics were developed
pretty lush grass over there.
Yeah, great grass. So they do very well. They're a great breed. And so one reason you choose a breed is the purpose that you want that breed to serve, whether it's milk or beef and what kind of beef. And then the second is your environment. And every microclimate is different. The soils are different. Every farm is different, which is why in the space of a few tens of miles in England, you'd go from one breed, from Herefords, Polled Herefords, to Devons, to Shorthorns, to Aberdeen Angus, to Galways, to Guernseys, to Jerseys. And so you pick a breed that will match your environment. And then finally, since you're going to be with these girls all the time, it's just like any guy, you're going to pick girls you like looking at.
There you go. Can you, you know, the name of this show is To Your Health. We're talking with John Whiteside at Wolf Creek Farm in Madison. John, if you could talk about the health benefits of eating this beef.
Yeah, so I'll have to start by saying a lot of people here in Charlottesville are vegetarian or vegan.
Right.
And they come to me oftentimes and say, you know, it's horrible what you're doing raising cattle. And there's two things I say to them. The first is I ask them, do you know the definition of salad? And usually they say, no, what's the definition of salad? And I say, it's what dinner eats for lunch. So we humans are omnivores.
Right.
And we need protein to sustain ourselves. And you can get protein from vegetable sources like soy. But it's not complex amino acid structures. It doesn't give you everything that you as an omnivore, a human, need. And therefore, you have to supplement with chemical additives called vitamins. We prefer, as omnivores, to eat the minerals that we need, and to intake the amino acids and enzymes that we can't produce by eating animal proteins. Those animal proteins, in the case of beef, are very different if that animal was raised on grass from nutrient-dense soils than if it's animal protein that came from an animal in a feedlot that was eating grains that were grown in a monoculture on depleted soils that were propped up with chemical fertilizers, pesticides, and herbicides. Essentially, you are what you eat. So the animal, its muscle, is what it ate. And if it was eating out of a food trough from conventional monoculture grain farms, it will have a very different chemical structure than if it was eating on nutrient-dense grasses. For example, the omega-3 to omega-6 fatty acid ratios will be totally different. High omega, good ratios on the grass-based and not so good on the corn-based. The CLA, the other fatty acids, the enzyme structures, all the nutrients and the vitamins are naturally in the grass-fed beef if it's coming from good soils and it's not in the feedlot beef.
Yeah, the the CLA is an antioxidant. So conjugated linoleic acid is an antioxidant that helps prevent cancer.
Well, essentially, most of the chronic diseases that we have as a modern culture are a function of an immune deficiency or an immune reaction. And that comes from our gut. That's where our immunity comes from. And we're born with a healthy gut if our mother was healthy. And it's just like with cattle. We will have healthy cattle if the cows are healthy, they're eating healthy, they raise a healthy calf if it is eating healthy and its gut is filled with microbes from the mother and then from the soil. Likewise, as humans, if we're eating foods that are nutrient-dense foods, we were lucky enough to be born to a mother who was healthy and was eating well, which is why so many of our customers are young women who are in childbearing rearing age who want to make sure that they're passing on to their children a great immune system. So they want to eat healthy, then they want to feed their children healthy alternatives or options so that they stay healthy. And if you look back historically, two generations ago, we spent 35% of our gross income on natural, traditional, farm-raised foods, mm-hmm. and less than 5% on medicine. Today, we're spending close to 25% on health care, and we're spending 5% on food. We've accomplished exactly what our government wanted and our industry, who supports the government, wanted, which was drive the cost of food down by creating conventional farming, chemical-based farming, and drive the cost of health care up. You can do the reverse for yourself, drive your health care costs down, but you'll have to spend more for food because you'll have to get nutrient-dense foods to supplement your body.
Right.
Well, that certainly is some of the emphasis here on the show is food as medicine. Excuse me, I just want to let you know that you're listening to WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. I'm Larry Stopper here with MC Blair and John Whiteside of Wolf Creek Farm. And John, I had a question about bulls. When I, again, when I was a young man and fooling with this stuff a little bit more, I had a couple of less than positive interactions with bulls. One of them chased me out of a pasture, me running as fast as I could go to get out of there. And another time when we were purchasing a milk cow, they had a bull in a very tight confinement, and he was huge. And their response when we went over to check him out was, don't even put your hand inside that enclosure. He's just so ornery. So how do you handle your bulls? Have you got some? Are you able to keep them calm? And talk to me about that a little bit. I'm really curious.
Well, handling cattle is a lot easier than humans because I've met very few animals or cattle that are dishonest. And the few that I have are now on a bun.
Yeah.
So with bulls, it's very simple. They're 50% of the genetic makeup of your herd, so they're critical. And you want a herd that's easy to work with. I'm with my cattle every day, all day. I don't want bad-tempered cattle, so I'm not going to select a bull that is bad-tempered. I want healthy cattle. I want cattle that are fertile. I want cattle that grow well. I want cattle that produce marbled beef and that produce it efficiently, convert grass to beef efficiently. So I'm looking for all those traits. I want cattle that last a long time, so they've got to have strong feet. So with your bulls, you're looking for all of those indicators. And if I had a bull that charged me, he'd leave the farm that day.
Yeah, I guess.
So the answer is very simple. Have a good eye for your cattle and select what you want. And what is happening on a lot of farms is they're, in the case of milk, they're pushing for one thing, which is get the most volume of sure. liquid product out of that udder as possible. So they're selecting bulls to give you that. And if the temperament's bad or the feet are bad or anything else, don't worry about that. We'll just confine it to a lot. We work with our bulls all the time. So the bulls are breeding the spring herd for 2 months, then they have 4 months off, then they breed the fall herd for 2 months, and then they're 4 months off. We put them, as soon as they leave the cow herd, we put them all back together again, and like men, they punch each other, they fight for a few minutes until they figure out who's the boss, and they get their pecking order together, and then they live the life of Riley for 4 months, get their weight back up, and then they go back out and breed cows for 2 months.
They do. So they just establish that pecking order. I mean, we're always a little bit afraid of putting two bulls in a pasture together. But
well, bulls are just like humans, or humans are just like bulls.
Okay.
Okay? It's very simple. If you have a small young bull and a big older bull, the young bull might go butt heads for a couple of minutes before he figures out how heavy this big bull is. And the big bull will say, this is a little guy, I'm going to let him think he's playing, and then every once in a while I'll give him enough of a butt that he'll know not to mess. So you don't have any problems there. That takes a couple of minutes. The only time you have problems is when you have two bulls that are exactly the same size, exactly the same age, both of whom think they ought to be boss.
Yeah.
And they'll keep at it for a while.
Yeah.
And usually they'll become best buddies.
Really, so you don't feel like you have to separate them. Even then, you just let them work it out.
Right. And every once in a while, a bull will get hurt. You know, boys roughhouse and they get hurt.
Yeah.
But if it got hurt because one of the bulls was mean and was not natural, was just nasty, then you've got to get rid of that bull. Yeah. But if it was boys roughhousing, that's life.
Okay. All right. It's interesting. That's great information, which I've always sort of carried that question in the back of my mind, especially as I was running out of that field at absolute top speed.
Well, the other thing is cattle know when you're afraid.
Yeah, right. This one's true new.
An animal, you can't let an animal know that it's stronger than you are or you're going to have trouble.
Yeah.
So working with bulls in particular, when they turn on you and want to try, you've got to smack them on the nose and tell them turn around.
I'm impressed because we're talking about a not quite ton animal, but I'm sure approaching it.
Yeah, 1,800 to 2,200 pounds.
Yeah, okay, yeah. A good ton. Okay, yeah.
So you harvest around the 22. 100 pounds.
No, that's a bull.
Oh, that's a bull. Okay.
So we castrate the bull calves at birth.
Oh, okay.
It's the most humane way to do it, and then we raise them as steers, and they'll finish at 2 years old at roughly 1,100 to 1,200 pounds.
Oh, that sounds reasonable.
Almost manageable.
Right.
All right. Talk to me a little bit about how you prevent your cattle from, well, I'll go back and again talk about my experience with it was that we always had the cattle wandering down, not a lot of cattle, a couple of cows, wandering down to the stream to just drink out of the stream. But I'm noticing on your website that you try to stay away from letting the cattle into the stream. Talk to me a little about that.
Yeah, so the fundamental thing that cattle need is water. They drink about 30, a grown cow will drink about 30 to 35 gallons a day.
Wow.
And that water needs to be clean, it needs to be fresh, it needs to be cool. And if they're going to be sitting in that water all day long defecating, it's not going to be clean or cool.
Fresh.
And you want the water that's leaving your farm to be every bit as clean as the water that enters your farm. One of the things that I did in searching for a farm 20 years ago was I wanted a farm that was right up against the mountains so that all the water on my farm rose on the farm.
That's
so I
great.
Didn't have to worry about it going through any other place. Right. I knew it was clean when it started. Then my job was to use it efficiently and to make it leave the farm in exactly the same shape as it entered the farm. And the way you do that is fence your cattle out of the streams and bring the water to them in forms like gravity-fed waterers or nose pumps or small areas they can get into that are rock-based to get to that creek to get a drink. And the other thing that you do is you improve the organic content in your soil. For every 1% improvement in the organic content of your soil, you're increasing the holding the water-holding capacity of your land by thousands of gallons an acre. So if you're talking about 1,000 acres or 2,000 acres, that's a lot of water that you are conserving for your farm, and then it'll run into your streams through the soil and be clean water as it's leaving your property.
So you use the water, but in essence, the water comes down from the mountain, you use it, and then discharge it, and in the same in the same shape it entered your farm.
Well, actually, it's even better than that.
Better.
Because what we're doing is we're creating a huge sponge that will hold this 42 inches of rain per year that we get here in Virginia. Instead of letting that water hit the ground and run right off into the streams and get down into the Rapidan or Rappahannock River and out into the Chesapeake, because we're farming naturally and we're getting organic carbon-rich soils, we're holding that water, we're using the water, and then we're releasing it slowly into the creeks. And so we're not only not putting bad things into the water, but we're increasing the retention of the water in the land and being a reservoir for the rivers that we're feeding so that we don't have the ebbs and flows that you usually see where you have huge runoff after a rainstorm, all the rivers are muddy, and then the rivers get low during a drought.
All right, well, you are listening to Your Health here on WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. I'm Larry Stopper here with MC Blair and our guest, John Whiteside. We're going to go to a break right now. We'll talk to you in a couple of minutes. Welcome back to Your Health. This is Larry Stopper here with MC Blair on WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. And we appreciate you all listening today. We're going to slip on over to our segment called In the News. That's sort of my area. I'm newspaper addicted, I admit it. And so I was reading this article this week about pollinators. And all right, so we all, well, many of us know that pollinators are particularly under stress these days, especially wild honeybees. Particularly seen the cause seems to be habitat loss and excessive pesticide use. So in an article published in the journal Science, a team of researchers has proposed 10 clear ways in which government and you and I can start to help pollinators because they need help.
They do.
They need a lot of help right now. So the 10 suggestions that we can sort of talk about them a little bit as we run through them is raise pesticide regulatory standards. And here we were just with John Whiteside from Wolf Creek Farm. No pesticides at all. And that's really sort of the answer.
It's sustainable.
Yeah. You know, skip the pesticides.
Yeah.
Especially, what is it, the neonicotinoids? Is that how it's pronounced?
Yes, yeah.
Those seem to be just killing off the bees. Promoting integrated pest management. Include indirect and sublethal effects in genetically modified crop risk assessments. Meaning, stop putting so much pesticide and herbicide in the genetically modified stuff that you are basically killing the wild pollinators.
And the soil.
Yeah, absolutely, and the soil. Regulate movement of managed pollinators so as not to do sort of endless crossbreeding. Develop incentives such as insurance schemes to help farmers benefit from ecosystem services instead of agrochems. And again, this goes right back to our interview with John that we've just been going through, because John is running a totally organic farm. They're not using any agrochemicals. And funny, he's got healthy animals.
Yeah.
It works. It's astonishing. I know. Let's see. The sixth is recognize pollination as an agricultural input. Imagine that. And that, I mean, it's just sort of basic stuff, and yet they actually have to put these articles out in the magazine Science because farmers and individuals are just not following these practices anymore. Here's number seven, is support diversified farming systems. Again, right back to what
there
John
is.
Has been talking about the whole time. Number eight is conserve and restore green infrastructure, a network of habitats that pollinators can move between in agricultural and urban landscapes. Now, that goes to individuals out here in Nelson, Albemarle, Fluvanna, wherever you're listening. Leaving natural habitat for pollinators to simply occupy, leaving your milkweed for the butterflies, for the monarchs, not mowing endlessly, but letting some areas run wild.
Absolutely.
This is the kind, because that's their habitat, folks.
Yep.
This is where they live. Number nine is develop long-term monitoring of pollination and pollinators. And, of course, that's the government that really needs to get in there and keep monitoring how the populations overall, in a much broader sense, are doing. And number 10 was fund research on improving yields in organic, diversified, and ecologically intensified farming.
That's important.
Yeah. And again, I mean, all this is just great to follow on behind John's interview here, because it seems pretty clear from the evidence that we're decimating the natural systems with every endless dose of herbicide and pesticide
that
we, I don't know, rain down upon insects, pollinators, all of the various little inhabitants that make up an ecosystem.
And not only that, but when we use those chemicals, pesticides, herbicides on the plants, that goes into the plant makeup and then into our bodies.
Absolutely,
so,
right into
hey,
us.
Hey, let's have some poison. You know, that's what I want for breakfast.
Absolutely,
you know?
Absolutely. A little dose of poison with your juice. All right, now this was a really interesting article. I pulled this out of the New York Times the other day. This one really fascinated me. The headline was an edible solution to extending the shelf life of produce.
Sounds good.
All right, this was pretty interesting now, because we all know that there's a real battle in farming, especially large, I mean, not especially, but absolutely in large agricultural operations that are like your famous tomato farms down in Florida and such, that are growing tomatoes in winter and somehow packing those red, I don't know, could be substituted for baseballs, and trying to get them to the grocery store so that they can masquerade as a tomato. Because produce is picked long before it's ripened and before its flavor and nutritional value have been close to fully realized, because if the farmers wait that long, by the time you're through with all the shipping and various other processes involved, it's old and nearing the end of its life. And we know that grocery stores pull vegetables off their shelves that are still perfectly good,
yeah,
but are starting to show a little bit of signs of not being perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this was an amazing example, and I know this is sort of stretching it a little bit because, well, it takes 30 days to get blueberries grown in Chile to market in the U.S. 30 days. Now, first of all, honestly, if you're trying to live a more sustainable life, you shouldn't be eating blueberries from Chile in the winter.
No, eat them in season locally.
Yeah, try to eat them in season. But nonetheless, 30 days. So here's, and that's just so ridiculous as far as how far in advance you have to pick these vegetables and fruits in order to get them to market. So this is, all right, so with that background, here's what's really cool. There's a startup in Southern California that's trying to make obsolete the gas and wax and other tricks that growers are using to get fruits and vegetables to extend the amount of time that they stay reasonably fresh. Company's called Appeal Sciences, and they've developed a method for creating an imperceptible edible barrier. I love that part, which controls the rate of water and gases that go in and out of produce, thus slowing down the rate of decay. Amazingly, the material that they're using to create this barrier, it's created out of leaves, stems, banana peels, the grape skins after they're crushing the grapes for wine, all sorts of other plant material. So it's edible, although let's not get carried away. I don't think it sounds very appealing. But that's all right. It's natural. And all the product has already started to work in smaller tests. And if it's successful in larger experiments, it really could have a huge effect on the amount of food that's wasted every year. Now, that's another issue. As one expert in the article comments, the answer to feeding the growing world's population, which we've already talked about quite a bit on the show, isn't to just grow more food. It's to preserve what we have and
yes,
not throw so much of it away, because that's what we do.
Amen.
That's amazing.
I know. We could feed a lot of people with what we throw away.
And in fact, there was a story the other day about two young men in Philadelphia that were arrested for dumpster diving vegetables that were still quite good shape, but they weren't perfect for the grocery store.
Yeah.
Because it's amazing how much they throw away. All right, so the first major experiment using this new technique was over in Nigeria, funded by the Gates Foundation. They're trying to help small African farmers get cassava root to market. So cassava root is a really important food source in Central Africa. But, and again, here's news to me, it starts to deteriorate substantially in just 24 to 48 hours.
Mm.
So they of course, the road systems are terrible in Africa to begin with. But also, no, it's pretty darn hard to get vegetables to market in the world's most advanced infrastructure country, the United States, in 24 to 48 hours, unless you're picking it and rushing it out to the farmer's market.
Right.
So Appeal, they've been experimenting with Appeal's product over in Nigeria, and it has basically doubled the amount of time that they have before the cassava starts to deteriorate.
That's good.
So it's showing real signs of success, and these are the kinds of breakthroughs, at least in my opinion, that really can make a difference in how we feed the world.
Yeah, absolutely.
We have to figure out how to feed all these billions of people. It's my theme. Because I don't know. I can't get over how many people there are when you sit down and really think about it. So how to feed them.
You're listening to Your Health on WPBC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, with me, MC Blair, and Larry Stopper. And we were just talking about a new method of keeping produce fresher longer. Seems to be working in the areas that they started with in Nigeria, and that's really, really interesting. As far as I'm concerned, I think that's great.
I love seeing companies really work on these kinds of almost seemingly esoteric issues.
Right.
You can,
right.
I mean, why change? You can dip that cucumber in wax and ship it off, for it's sit in your refrigerator for a month. It's still there.
Well, one of the things you mentioned about feeding large numbers of people and still being sustainable, if you will, there's actually a program here in Charlottesville called Schoolyard Gardens.
Uh-huh.
And what they do, Larry, is they are educating the children of today on sustainable practices. They show them, they teach them. The kids raise produce, taking the ground that the school sits on and plowing some of it up and turning it into a garden. And then the food ends up at lunchtime. So they end up feeding the students. And
right.
Yeah. So I think that if this continues, and more schools are able to participate and more students get educated over time, those students will grow up to be adults and they will demand the right kind of food, real food, I call it. And so on and so forth. And if that continues to go, more and more people will get into it. You'll see a lower rate of childhood obesity. You'll see a lower rate of diabetes. And there's lower health care costs. And that will go right into to making healthier people. And so that's just, I think that is the absolute answer.
Maybe we can even inspire some of them to go John Whiteside's route and start to raise healthy animals and healthy food for us. I mean, once you get your hands in the ground, that was really the experience for me when I was 18 and first really went to a farm, left suburban New Jersey and went up to a farm and worked on raising food. I couldn't stand green vegetables as a little kid. I mean, you couldn't shove a pea down my throat. If you could hold me down. Four people couldn't get it down my throat. But there I was in a garden the first time picking peas, and somebody shelled one of them and handed it to me. Crunchy, sweet, delicious.
Yep.
I had no idea.
No idea.
All I'd ever seen in my life was frozen peas.
Right.
It was a revelation that stayed with me forever. I've grown some food through, except for my college years, I guess, but I've grown some food for the last 40 years, something, all the time.
Yeah. It gets to you, and then you get used to that wonderful taste, and obviously your body thanks you by being healthy.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's see. Do we have time for one more quickie here? I'm going to shove one in real quick here.
Okay.
I got one more little segment here I want to show, because there's a new study out of the UK that shows that the spread of cancer in the body is enhanced by fat intake. So mice were given a high-fat diet, including, and this was what was really interesting to me, including a substantial amount of palmitic acid, which is the major component of palm oil. And palm oil is one of those food items, I don't know what you'd call it, that is in all your processed foods. If you look on the back of that label, I've probably used palm oil somewhere. It's in everything from regular peanut butters to toothpaste. And the mice that were fed the higher fat diets, the cancer that was injected into them spread at a hugely substantial rate, faster rate than the mice that were fed a low fat diet.
The bad fats.
The bad fats. So, I mean, it just emphasizes again what we talked about here so many times on the show. The closer to the source of the food you are eating, the better off you're going to be. It's just a fairly simple equation.
Exactly.
Go to the farmer's market. Know where your food is grown. Know who's growing it, and you're just going to be better off all the way through.
Absolutely. And speaking of good fats, that is one of the things that John had mentioned, the ratio of omega-3 to omega-6. The closer to 1-to-1 you get, the better. And, the bad fats are those ones that were raised on grain or at least finished on grain. They're somewhere in the 6-to-1 of omega-6 to omega-3 as opposed to a 1-to-1 And most of the good grass-fed beef that is out there is a 1.5, 1.25 to 1, which is really, really good. And those are good fats.
Okay. All right, well, you've been listening to Your Health. This is Larry Stopper with my co-host,
MC Blair.
All right, on WPVC, we appreciate you listening. Stay tuned for Club Sabor, great Latin music, and we'll see you soon.
And we're not going to be airing next Saturday or the following Saturday. That's Christmas Eve and New Year's Eve, but we will be back on January 4th.
You've been listening to Your Health with your hosts, Larry Stopper and MC Blair. To Your Health is brought to you by Hamilton's at First and Main, celebrating 20 years of sustainable fine dining on the downtown mall. Be listening again next Saturday at 11 for To Your Health. The show is produced by Ben Chambers, production assistance from Mike Friend.